So the question is there any difference between the tango we may have with the external world and the tango you have with yourself? There will be differences, of course. You know, and I think there's probably a grave danger in, you know, assuming that it's all internal somehow, you know, and the internal is being manifested externally. We have to recognize, and we move through a world of interfacing tangles, interacting tangles. And, you know, the causes of another person's tangle, for example, may be quite different than the roots of our own tangles. They just interact. Anything else up? Okay, I hope you've all had some successes and in finding your tangles during that walking period. And of course, there are those who are completely tangle-free. So as I mentioned this morning, I want to really focus on two particular discourses from the Middle Length Sayings this weekend. The first of these, at first glance, looks really quite simple because it's quite short, but what I've discovered in the discourses is length has got nothing to do with complexity. You know, sometimes the shortest ones have got actually the most in them. But again, I want to really encourage you once more just to remind, to think of how this would look in your own practice and in your own life and in your own experience, okay? So this first teaching is called the two kinds of thought. Now, already that probably sounds really simplistic to you. You know, you probably think I have 10,000 kinds of thoughts. So the Buddha's distilling this great complex narrative world we live in down to two basic streams of thinking that have different roots. So we have to remember that these two streams of thought, or these two kinds of thought, have great potential to proliferate into many, many narratives. So the narratives, the content of the narratives, is not actually what we're concerning ourselves with here. What we're actually looking at in this discourse is how the mind inclines and what leads the mind to incline towards certain ways of thinking. Now, when we do this, it's really important to remember the ways in which the state of our mind actually becomes the shape of our world. And I'm sure we can all recognize this. You know, if your mind is very anxious, how do you perceive the world? Not as filled with benevolent, kindly beings, but with threat, you know, and with intruders and imposers. You know, if your mind is filled with aversion, you very rarely perceive a world filled again with compassionate, generous people where all is well. The mind will actually perceive what is imperfect. It will be inclined to highlight what is imperfect and amiss and wrong externally. So we're looking at the roots of thinking here. We're looking at the core roots of thinking. Now, what I want to do as I go through these discourses is I'm going to paraphrase them a little, if you don't mind, because sometimes the language is even with the best of translations, still feels kind of stilted at times and, you know, uses vocabulary that we hardly ever use. But some of it is fine. So contextualize this. You know, the Buddha would wander through India, right? And he would bump into groups of people and he would be invited to give a teaching. So people would gather around to listen to a teaching, and then they would request it, and then they would usually say thank you, and some would get it and some wouldn't. But you have to recognize that these were quite informal affairs, you know, much, much less informal than what we're in right now. So here he's teaching a group of people. He says, "When I was still only an unenlightened seeker, it occurred to me, suppose that I divide my thoughts into two classes or two kinds. Then I set on one side thoughts of sensual desire, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of cruelty. And I set on the other side thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-ill will, and thoughts of non-cruelty. So remember, in the early teachings, things were often stated in terms of non-this, non-that. Non-ill will is thoughts of kindness and friendliness. Thoughts of non-cruelty are thoughts of compassion and care. Thoughts of renunciation are perhaps more obvious to us. So what the Buddha is actually starting to say here and introduce is a simple knowing quality of the mind and knowing the mind through a certain lens. So think of how that would be for you if you would turn your attention inwardly and actually divide your thoughts or know your thoughts under these two lights or through these two lens. Ah, this is a thought of ill will. Okay, so think of ill will, okay? This is a big spectrum, right? Aversion, judgment, frustration, impatience, jealousy, criticism, you know. So think of the thoughts of ill will. Think of the thoughts of cruelty, okay? Cruelty sounds like a big word. Harsh thoughts, unforgiving thoughts, ungenerous thoughts about ourselves or others. Thoughts of sensual desire. Now, you might well be asking, well, what's wrong with sensual desire? You know, it seems like a big deal is made about this in early teachings, isn't it? You know, there's a constant encouragement to be quite wary of sensual desire. Thoughts of sensual desire, you know. I really like this. I really want this. You know, that's really beautiful. You know, I really need this. You know, how do I get this? You know, how do I arrange my world in order to have more of that which pleases me and affirms me? So here's my first question to you. Why are thoughts of sensual desire made such a big deal of in the teachings? You know, why is there so much encouragement to refrain from these endless pursuits of sensual desire and sensual pleasure? That is actually a question, by the way. That is a question. Remember what I said, this is not all from the front. Because they're based on greed, because they have a certain background. And where does greed arise from? A sense of lack, a sense of insufficiency. So the Buddha wasn't actually trying to prescribe a world where we didn't appreciate anything or didn't enjoy anything or didn't delight in anything. He was actually really encouraging us to look at where these so pressing and insistent thoughts and actions around gaining sensual desire actually arise from. And, you know, if we look honestly at our days, we can actually see how much time is spent trying to rearrange the conditions of the moment so that we maximize the pleasant and minimize the unpleasant. Now, on one level, we can say this is completely human and understandable and natural, you know. We want to feel good and we don't want to feel bad. No one is going to be blamed for that. The reality is, of course, when that turns into an insistence, we lose our resilience, equanimity, and capacity to meet life as it is, where we can't always control the conditions that we have only the pleasant and none of the unpleasant. And so we tend to crumble in the face of the difficult or the unpleasant or the unpleasing into aversion and into pushing away and into getting rid of and into this endless pursuit to actually have only moments that please me and affirm me. Because in some level in our mind, you know, this is a measure of success, isn't it, in our culture? The more I'm able to actually achieve only the pleasant and get rid of the unpleasant, you know, we could define that as success. Unfortunately, we live in an uncooperative world. We also live with an uncooperative body, I might mention, and an uncooperative mind. So the Buddha says, you know, the Buddha's pointing out as to how much compulsion there is in this, you know, how much compulsion there is in the abandoning of the unpleasant and the fleeing and the pursuit of the pleasant as a way of securing a self that feels affirmed and protected and good and only ever good. So when the Buddha is constantly cautioning us about kind of this compulsion, he is asking us to look underneath those mind moments, you know, because mind moments become behavior moments, don't they? They become behavior moments. This is actually what starts to drive our lives, starts to govern our actions and our choices. He says, look, this compulsion is arising from greed, but greed has an even deeper foundation, which is a sense of insufficiency, a sense of lack, a deficit culture. I'm not enough, I don't have enough, I'm not good enough. And my confused way of addressing that is actually to secure as much of the pleasant as we can. In Buddhist psychology, this is called bhava tanha, the desire for becoming. I want to become the kind of person who has only good experiences, pleasant people, children who thrive, who never fails, my car doesn't break down, I go on perfect vacations, and I have wonderful neighbors. That's the kind of person I want to be. This is all rooted in sensual desire, you know. I don't want to be the kind of person, you know, whose children have difficulties and struggle, you know, whose vacations fail, you know, whose neighbors are miserable, you know, and who never actually achieves as much as the person next door. I don't want to be that kind of person. So you will see throughout the teachings, the early teachings, you know, this is not a sort of like grim, beauty-denying teaching. It's not about sort of suppressing our capacities to truly delight in and appreciate that which is lovely. In fact, there is much that is spoken about the value of that kind of appreciation. But it's actually looking at the difference between that kind of sensual appreciation, which is part of all of our lives, and this compulsion of sensual desire. Now, this manifests in thoughts. It manifests in thoughts. It manifests in the thoughts about what I believe I want, what I believe I need, what I believe I must get, must have, must become. And alongside of that, of course, is always cooperating all of the thoughts about what I can't bear and what I can't tolerate and what I want to get rid of. Okay? So the first instruction is, so I set on one side the thoughts of sensual desire. The thoughts of ill will. Now, ill will, again, doesn't sound too bad, but, you know, it's that very big spectrum of agitation, isn't it? The thoughts of ill will about what I have to get rid of, what I can't bear, you know, the little flinches in our life of, you know, that condition's not acceptable, you know, that person's not acceptable, you know, this body experience is not acceptable, to the real extremes of, you know, the judging, self-critical, condemning, blaming, shaming mind that, quite frankly, can beset people quite severely. So I put this on one side. I hold it in one hand. Think of holding it in one hand. And the thoughts of cruelty, just the harshness, you know, the harshness, the blaming, the unforgiving, uncompassionate kind of thoughts that can beset us. Okay, are you with me on this? Are you know this kind of thinking? Okay. And I said on the other side, thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of friendliness, kindness, generosity, and thoughts of non-cruelty, the thoughts of compassion. Now, bearing in mind here, when we use the word thought in Buddhist psychology, we're often not only talking about cognitive thinking, we're talking about intention. We're talking about the intentions that guide our actions, that guide our lives, that guide our speech. So the first step of what the Buddha is actually talking about here is first the establishment of the simple knowing. The simple knowing aspect of mindfulness, to know what our mind is doing, to know what direction our mind is going in, to begin to sense that landscape, to begin to know it, to have a vocabulary for it. You know, so much of these intentions, so many of our intentions are often unconscious, aren't they? So the Buddha's talking about bringing our intentions and the cognitive expression of those intentions into the light of awareness. To know the mind. To know the mind as it is. And I abided thus. Okay. I abided thus. This is a line that you will find in many of the discourses. Diligent, ardent, and resolute. Well, anybody a little bit ambivalent about all of this? You know, like it doesn't really matter, you know. Why does it really matter? You know, the Buddha speaks so much about this kind of attitude, this kind of core energy that is really needed in the process of transformation. You know, you think about the word ardency. What do you usually associate ardency with? Falling in love, you know, or something that you're really passionate about. This is the kind of ardency that the Buddha says is absolutely key if we're actually really going to be, if we're really going to wake up in this life, if we're really going to untangle the tangles, diligent, you know, steady in one's path. Isn't it so easy to get diverted and to get distracted, you know, and to become forgetful? Isn't it just so easy to see those habit patterns of forgetfulness in our lives, you know, or to think like the small things don't really matter? Or to think, you know, I'll reserve that diligence, you know, for when I get to my cushion, you know, or maybe my next retreat, you know, how much we can feel so drawn into just quite frankly, the sheer busyness of making our lives operate, that, you know, that forgetfulness creeps in. And resolute. The Buddha's very clear on this question of resolution. To know that we're actually on a path, and I would really encourage you to kind of make this difference or this distinction, please, between having a practice and being on a path. Being on a path is very, very different than having a practice. Having a practice is good, but it's a very small piece of a path, isn't it? A path has a beginning, and it has a direction, and it has a fruition. And this is so clearly taught and so clearly laid out in this teaching. Where does the path begin? With the tangle. That's the classroom. That's where the path begins, is the tangle, the confusion, the misunderstanding, the sense of being lost, the sense of just not quite knowing what's going on. You know? And the tangle is also the classroom. This is where the path is really cultivated, within the tangle. And the path has a fruition. And I just want you to register what the fruition of this path is. For them, the tangle has faded away. That suffering has come to an end. That distress and suffering has come to an end. So the Buddha is really talking, actually, about, you know, this sense of development, this sense of having a direction, and this possibility of fruition. And for that path to be followed, or to really brought to fruition, really requires these qualities of diligence, ardent, and resolution. And, you know, please don't feel uncomfortable if that makes you feel uncomfortable. You know, because I think the whole of the teaching actually was really designed to actually make us a little bit uncomfortable. You know, to actually stimulate some sense of possibility and some confidence in that possibility. Do remember that Buddha was walking around India. He was talking to all kinds of people, you know, thieves, murderers, you know, serial killers, you know, ordinary folks, you know, tilling their farms, you know. And he says this is your possibility, is to actually come to actually the same liberating understandings that I have come to. The Buddha always sought graduates. He didn't seek eternal followers or students. And I think there is something, you know, that can be a little bit, how would I say, a little bit overlooked, I think, in Western practice, where people can get resigned to a sort of limited sense of possibility. But I do want to encourage you to think of yourself as being a student of awakening, as being a student of nirvana. Not just about getting better at negotiating with samsara or negotiating with the tangle. So I really want to encourage you in this direction as we talk about these discourses, because all of the discourses have this at their heart, that these are teachings in an awakening process. And for them to be teachings in an awakening process, in so many ways, we really need to claim them as our own. To claim them as genuine possibilities. So I'll go on a little bit and then we'll have a pause moment. Okay. So as I abided thus, and you remember the Buddha here is talking about his own practice, okay? This is when he was, you know, not awakened. So he's talking about his own practice and his own genuine sort of explorations within the context of this tangle. So he's talking about his own learning process. So as I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of sensual desire arose in me. And I understood thus, this thought of sensual desire has arisen in me. This leads to my own affliction, to others' affliction, and to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from nibbana. Notice this is relational. It's not just that this is an inconvenient thought or intention of sensual desire. He's actually speaking about the imprint or the footprint of those intentions of sensual craving, sensual desire, upon the world around him, and upon the minds of others. It's very clear this has an outcome. Okay? It's not just that this has arisen, but this actually has an outcome. And the outcome is that it is leading away from freedom. And that it's causing difficulty for himself and for others in his life. When I considered this leads to my own affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered this leads to other affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered this leads to the affliction of both, the intention subsided in me. When I considered this obstructs wisdom, it causes difficulty and leads away from nibbana, it subsided in me. Whenever a thought of sensual desire arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, did away with it. Okay.
He just considered, but it's the considering. He kind of, what you're saying is that he reflected on it or looked at it and said, this isn't going to serve me.
Yes, he reflected on it, he looked at it, he saw it for what it was, he saw it was where it was going to take him. So first, that simple knowing, he says, it subsided in me. Why does something subside in us? Because we don't feed it. Intentions and the thoughts that manifest those intentions, say, for sensual desire, they don't have an independent self-existence, do they? For that thought to sustain, or that intention to sustain of I need this, I want this, I must have this, it requires feeding. It requires feeding. So how do we feed and sustain those intentions and those thoughts, usually by throwing more thoughts at it. I need this because. If I don't have this, this will happen to me, or I will be like that. The kind of contracting and the tightening in the narrative is feeding that intention, turning it into a compulsion, turning it into an insistence. The Buddha says, when I saw it for what it was, it began to subside in me. He learned something from it, basically. He learned something from it. He learned about where it goes, about the outcome, about its impact upon himself, upon others, and about where it was going to take him. It was going to take him back into very familiar places. I think that's really important to recognize. You know? We can watch a lot of things without learning from them, can't we? You know, we can suffer without really learning anything from it. I mean, I think for that learning to take place really requires some of these, you know, very resolute considerations as where is this going to take me? And if I see it's really going to take me into affliction and away from freedom, I bring that resolution not to feed it. Now, you notice it goes on. He says, and then on the basis of that learning, on the basis of that insight, whenever that thought of sensual desire or craving arose in me, that intention arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, and did away with it. So it's kind of, it's not much ambivalence there, is it? It's kind of not like maybe, you know, or maybe for a little bit, you know, or maybe for a little while, maybe it's not so bad. He says, I abandoned it. And you see this word abandon it quite a lot in the early teachings, you know, and I think as Westerners, you know, when we hear that word abandon or did away with it, you know, we kind of translate that inwardly into some sort of suppression or avoidance or, you know, a kind of harshness. The Buddha's actually saying, I took certain steps on the basis of what I have learned, on the basis of insight. Just, and I wonder how you translate that in your own experience. I mean, have you ever found, let me think of an example. Well, repetitive thinking, I mean... Let's get real. You know, the cycles that we walk around quite a few times, you know. You know, say about some sense of lack, you know, some sense of lack, you know, and how that sense of lack might get turned into some kind of obsession. You know, I just need to have this kind of person in my life, you know, or the perfect teacher or, you know, the perfect situation, and how we can go round and round and round in those circles. And, you know, there's quite a lot of suffering going round in those circles, isn't it? It's not really a very happy place. You know, obsession is generally not a place of happiness. But there's a certain addiction quality to it, isn't it? You know, because otherwise, why would we do it? You know, why would we do something that leads to our affliction and leads to the affliction of others? And I think sometimes there's this kind of like secret hope, you know, like if I just go around that loop one more time, like maybe there's going to be some precious drop of insight that comes out of it, or, you know, some transforming solution or moment, you know. It's a little hook there that leads us to go round and round. And I think what the Buddha's actually saying here is I've let go of that hook, you know, that well is dry. You know, there is no more insight. I'm just going round in circles. How would it look for you to abandon one of those repetitive loops? How would you do that? And by the way, noticing that the Buddha's putting, abandonment is sometimes another word for renunciation, but he's putting this together with the intentions of kindness and compassion. Putting that together with the intentions of kindness and compassion. So it's not doing this in order to become a better person or because this is a terrible thing to be doing. It's out of compassion for the affliction that is born of these repetitive cycles and being ensnared by this sensual craving and the sense of lack behind it. It's out of compassion for that that there is the resolution to abandon it. Does that make sense to you? Did not make sense to anybody. Yeah.
What I think about as I listen to you is it does make intellectual sense, and it's very logical, and it's very appealing. But in my experience, there's nothing as good as getting what I want.
Yeah. Did you everybody hear that? Mm-hmm. Could everybody hear that?
No.
Okay, so talking about that, I think something probably a lot of people in this room would recognize, you know, that, you know, logically, intellectually, you know this. You know these endless loops. But at the same time, the pleasure of getting what I want is so big that it creates a kind of forgetfulness in those moments. And I think that is what really, that's kind of what this lure of sensual craving really is. You know, it creates that forgetfulness, and it also creates the forgetfulness of just, you know, that this is actually leading to affliction, being caught in these rounds, you know. And the painfulness she's mentioning about knowing, you know, this gap between the intellectual knowing of that and then getting hooked into the drive of just getting what I want. And I think that's actually a good painfulness to stay with for a while. You know, I don't think there's anything amiss with recognizing that painfulness. Sometimes I think we don't actually absorb the painfulness of that gap deeply enough because we get busy getting something else that I want. Hmm? And mostly getting what I want is a way to actually keep us somehow a little bit distanced from the painfulness, the frustrating painfulness of knowing that is a momentary experience of relief from painfulness rather than feeling good about getting what I want. It's actually a relief from the painfulness of lack. And I think sometimes we know when we feel that painfulness of lack, it's so automatic to catapult ourselves into it, into a way of fixing that, isn't it? And the way of fixing that is by getting something that I want. And I think this is the sort of pathos of the human condition, isn't it? That, you know, we use craving as a solution to suffering, rather than really acknowledging how much craving is implicated in the creation of suffering. And I think it's just really useful, just, you know, on a life level, on a practice level, to really be quite willing to be quite close to those moments of when we are using craving as a solution for suffering, whereas actually the suffering is so much born of this sense of lack. So, you know, I think, you know, that process of actually, you know, waking up to those moments is just really, really significant, you know, because I think this whole teaching is about how do we move from the knowing of something to the living of something. You know, how do we move from that intellectual, cognitive agreement into a place of embodiment, which is the whole challenge of this path, isn't it? But I think the diligence part comes in by, you know, when we see ourselves moving in that direction of using sensual craving to solve suffering, to actually, are we willing in that moment to sort of be still and abandon it? And say, actually, maybe there's a value in staying close to this for a moment and actually see where it's arriving from. Yeah.
When I listen to you speak, what strikes me when you talk about embodiment is that not only is this a mind activity, but it's also very much a mind-body.
Absolutely.
And it strikes me that
Oh, yeah.
And so, for example, one of the things I found myself confronting and still confronting, for example, in our culture, we're inundated at a societal level with addictions of all kinds, you know, whether, it, you know, the blatant ones or the ones that have to do with sugar and everything else, and how even at a physiological level, our genes become addicted. But then changes how we think. And so we're really talking not only mind level, but a physical level.
Oh, absolutely.
And how difficult it is to, if one only works at the level of mind without dealing with the physical level. Like one can go to meditation, but if you go home and disassociate, where are you?
Yeah.
So I think we all really struggle with how do I integrate this at a mind body level in what is particular.
So I mean the question is really about embodiment and how do we move from a mind level where it's not only our minds that are inclining towards, you know, these kind of obsessions and compulsions, but it's also obviously very physiological. I mean, I think, you know, early on in Buddhist psychology, this was clearly recognized, you know. This was not just about today. This was clearly recognized. I mean, in early Buddhist psychology, there's no such thing as mind and body. There's mind-body. The Buddha was clearly cognizant that the mind is constantly sending messages to the body and the body is sending messages to the mind, that this is a two-way integrated circuit, you know, and mind was not always coming first, despite the line I read earlier, which is why in early Buddhist teaching, actually the behavioral element of the path was put foremost prior to the investigative nature of the path. You know, which is why, for example, ethics was so clearly established as the beginning point of the path. And it was very clear in the early teachings that, you know, what you did was shaping your mind. And how you behaved was actually going to interrupt some of the patterns that were most compulsive and addictive. But it was very clear, like the Buddha would say, like, you don't have to feel generous to be generous. If you want to know what generosity feels like, be generous. You know, if you want to know what compassion feels like, be compassionate. You know, if you want to know what kindness feels like, be kind. So we would often actually put the embodied part, the very physical behavioral part first, as the first step for beginning to change some of the habits of the mind. So it was never just mind-led first. You know, I'm going to really work on getting to feel really compassionate and then I'm going to go out in the world and be compassionate. It comes often the other way around, which is very challenging, I think, for Western ways of thinking where, you know, feeling is given a certain authority and authenticity that it never had in the early teachings. You know, like you don't have to feel something in order to do something. And that's why ethics was put so clearly at the beginning of the path. You know, if you plant your life and your body and your mind clearly in integrity, it's going to change your mind. It might challenge your behavior patterns, but in challenging your behavior patterns, it's going to actually change your mind. There was something else? Okay, we'll go on a bit. So the next couple of verses really just follow on from the first one in the same line. As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of ill will arose in me, a thought of cruelty arose in me. I understood this. This thought of cruelty has arisen in me. This leads to my own affliction, to others' affliction, and to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties and leads away from nirvana. When I considered this, it subsided in me. Whenever a thought of cruelty arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, and did away with it. So then comes this paragraph, which I think is really something to take to heart. Whatever a person frequently thinks and ponders upon, dwells upon, that will become the inclination of their mind. If they frequently think and dwell upon thoughts or intentions of sensual desire, they have abandoned the thought of renunciation to cultivate the thought of sensual desire. Do you get the import of that? Okay. If one frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of sensual desire, they have abandoned the thought of renunciation to cultivate the thought of sensual desire, and then their mind inclines towards thoughts of sensual desire. This is where I think it refers a little bit earlier to what you were speaking to earlier. To cultivate that intention of craving, the intentions of pursuing sensual desire, means already an abandonment of freedom, actually. It means in that moment an abandonment of freedom. And then in doing that, the mind inclines more frequently to those impulses and to those compulsions. Remember what I said earlier about the mind living in a state of potentiality and being shaped. This is where the mind is actually being shaped by certain habit patterns that, of course, have a background in other ideologies. If one frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of ill will, upon thoughts of cruelty, they've abandoned the thought of kindness. They've abandoned the thoughts of compassion. And then the mind inclines towards ill will and harshness. So what the Buddha is actually referring to here is that we are in a process of creating, feeding, and sustaining emotional and psychological habits. Creating, feeding, and sustaining emotional and psychological habits. But what it's also saying is that they do not coexist, for example. The freedom of the moment, the liberation of the moment, does not coexist with that impulse and that compulsion of craving. That kindness has been abandoned to cultivate and to dwell upon thoughts of ill will. That compassion has been abandoned in order to entertain thoughts of harshness. So he's saying these are not coexistent. These are not coexistent. Then if you reflect upon the whole development of sati, of mindfulness, one of the greatest and early gifts of mindfulness or sati is to be aware that there are choices. It's actually the freedom to step out of the place of impulse and compulsion and habit, and to be aware that when mindfulness is present, there is choice. And that when mindfulness is not present, there are very rarely choices in how our minds are operating. When mindfulness is not present, our minds are likely to go down the pathway of habitual impulse around cruelty, around ill will, around craving. It's quite a profound actually teaching in actually taking our seat in a way where there are choices, where there is the freedom from that which leads to affliction. And just as thoughts of cruelty are cultivated, or ill will or sensual craving are cultivated as habits, so too is kindness, compassion, renunciation also cultivated as intentions. These are not just, you know, lucky accidents that befall some and don't befall others. I think the whole direction of this teaching is to move out of episodic kindness, you know, or episodic renunciation or episodic compassion, into a way that these are naturalized as the intentions that actually guide our thought, speech, and action.
Christina?
Yes, please.
Talking that the words that the Buddha used are very they're given other attributes.
Yeah. We have normalized greed, you know, and we have normalized rage often, and we have often normalized hatred as being functional ways of navigating through this world and actually of getting what we want. And, you know, we don't actually see a happier world because of that. We don't see a freer world because of that. And we don't see a more cooperative and peaceful world because of that.
And again, too, along that line, it's like, years ago, I never would have considered myself a person that practiced greed. I mean, that was a little harsh. Maybe a little greedy. But I didn't understand the depth of what that word meant.
Yeah. And I think it's a very important point you're making, that we actually practice these things. You know, we practice them through how our minds dwell. We practice them with our speech. We practice them with our actions. And, you know, there's very core questions being asked here, you know, does this lead towards freedom or away from freedom? And as I mentioned earlier, every moment we are practicing something. You know, and without awareness, there's not choices really about what we practice. We feel driven. What we frequently think about and dwell upon becomes the inclination of the mind. So it's almost, you can see that if we practice anger or if we practice ill will, we do get much better at it, don't we? We get much more easily irritated. We're much more easily vexed. You know, we're much more easily impatient and reactive. Why is that so? Because we've been practicing it for so long. And we've got so good at it that it's become the inclination of the mind, and the inclination of the mind becomes the shape of the world. And as the Buddha says, often turns into how we describe ourselves. It turns into character, turns into self-definition. You know, I'm like this, I'm this kind of person. This gets into a slightly trickier part. Do you have a question? Sorry.
Just a comment on a couple of things that have been said here, and it just brings back a lot of the themes you've been talking about. But in my own practice or path following, this idea of sensing or learning that greed is in fact not the path to freedom, happiness, has required that connection with the body, mm-hmm. of feeling the body as it wants something, which in fact is an extremely unpleasant bodily feeling compared to the feeling of the body which perhaps first arose through meditation of what a mind-body is like where there isn't craving or a will. Yeah. And that is so much more pleasant. And so for me, you know, a huge insight was to be with the energy of craving, of greed, of wanting that piece of chocolate. And I realized that my mind had the story, the only way that compulsion is going to disappear is by actually getting the object of desire. Mm-hmm. To be able to be with the embodied sense of desire and just be with that energy and watch it move through and disappear without actually getting the object.
Yeah. I mean, it's why, you know, really, I mean, you know, the Buddha actually did put so much emphasis upon actually inner development, because this, you know, the culture of insufficiency, which is really the root of greed, is really not going to really disappear until we're convinced of inner sufficiency. You know, and it's why the Buddha put so much forward, you know, that formal inner development to really begin to taste inwardly generated happiness, inwardly generated joy, inwardly generated contentment, you know, which kind of really pulls the rug out from under craving. You know, it just doesn't make any sense. You know, and so it's you know, and I want to get into this, you know, because we often go about the path, I think, a little bit in the wrong direction, you know, because I think we have this such a deeply ingrained work ethic in our culture. And part of the way that that translates into the path is that we're going to work things out and work on things. You know, we're going to do a lot of work on things. And the result of working on the difficult is going to be the lovely. As far as I can read in the early teachings, it's completely the opposite direction. You know, you actually cultivate the healing, the lovely, the liberating, and this is actually what relinquishes the difficult. But I want to move on to that in a bit, okay? Yes. Well, you could go there, but you don't have to. Yeah, but there's something else operating there where we turn a teaching of liberation into a teaching of legislation. There's something else that's going on there. And it's more about kind of self-image or being perfect or about doing things right, you know, and sort of curbing rather than understanding, you know. And this is actually what the Buddha was so much, you know, actually, you know, the Buddha grew up in a culture or taught in a culture that was totally governed by rules, you know. That was early Buddhist culture. It was governed by rules. You know, you had certain rules that guaranteed your future if you obeyed them. You had certain rules that guaranteed, you know, you were going to be a respected person if you obeyed them. You had certain rules that you observed if you were going to be safe. And, you know, I think that's a very human tendency to rely upon rules for safety and control and, you know, perfection and acceptance and all the rest of it. And that was the culture actually the Buddha was actually flailing against. You know, he said, this is the kind of both external and internal culture that doesn't work because legislation is not the same as liberation. And we need to be, you know, that tendency to do that, actually, I think, just really needs to be included in the investigation. You know, rather than saying, no, I shouldn't do that, you know, or I need to deny myself or I shouldn't deny myself. I think we need to include that in the investigation of, you know, does this lead to affliction or does it lead to the end of affliction? You know, does this lead towards freedom or does it lead towards the end of freedom? So I think rather than, you know, going into these extremes of, you know, either totally sort of license, permissiveness, you know, do whatever I want, or go to the other extreme of denial and legislate, you know, I think we actually need to look in the what is in the middle there and what's leading the mind to go to those extremes, you know, because if we can see if either of those extremes are places of affliction. I just want to go on a little bit. I mean, I'm really appreciating your input, but I'm also aware we only have 2 days. But I'm glad, I'm really appreciating your engagement. I am, seriously. So here we're going into this really, really, really countercultural, non-social thinking. I was tempted to jump over this bit, but I don't think I can. Just as the last month of the rainy season in the autumn when the crops thicken, a cowherder would guard their cows by constantly tapping and guiding them on this side and that with a stick to check and curb them. Why is that? Because they see that if he could really get into trouble, actually it's much more extreme here, the cowherder could be flogged, imprisoned, fined, or blamed. If they let the cows stray into the crops. So, too, I saw in unwholesome states danger, degradation, and defilement, and in wholesome states the blessings of renunciation. And again, this sounds kind of extreme, but this is also puts it into a relational sense, you know. the pursuit of sensual desire, well, obviously has a huge imprint on our world and our environment, doesn't it? You know, it has a huge imprint on how we relate to each other. You know, who has more, who has less, who's to envy, you know, who do I compare myself with? We can see that the pursuit of sensual desire is often a sacrifice of, you know, what I want often holds precedence, doesn't it, over how this might affect those around me or the world around me. I mean, we appreciate the compulsiveness, the driven nature, actually, of sensual craving, and its affliction is not just personal. So the Buddha's actually encouraging us here, you know, it's really important in this, not just to consider this on a personal level. You know, am I a good person or a bad person? Am I a greedy person or a non-greedy person? He's actually really asking us to widen the circle of our concern and actually to see both on a personal level and a collective level the outcome of just being imprisoned by these perennial and persistent cravings to get away from the painful and the difficult. And this is actually where compassion is coming into this process. But there's something more, because the words from the Pali in this are, and this is where it gets a bit antsy for people, are hiri and otapa. Translates as wholesome shame or wholesome regret. And the reason I say that it's so kind of counterintuitive, you know, because we, you know, we do have such a rightful sense of trying to end so much of the shaming that goes on in our culture, which is about belittling people and, you know, people feeling terrible and you know, humiliated and not good enough. That we sort of also don't maybe also include this element of wholesome shame, which I think is really actually, I think there's a shortage of it, quite frankly. I mean, we know this. We know wholesome shame, don't we? I mean, you know, have you ever kind of, in the Tibetan language, it translates as becoming red-faced. I mean, you know, we know those moments, don't we, when we've said something really hurtful that we really would rather not have said or, you know, done something, you know, really, there's really a really counter to what we value. And you that first energetic rush, you know, of just, ooh. That's hiri and otapa. And the Buddha actually says, it's good to listen to this. It's good to listen to this. Not go into this big, you know, blaming, judging narrative, this kind of, you know, distorted sense of shaming. It's good to listen to this. It's good to listen to this because this is often drawing us back to an ethical compass. You know, it's often drawing us back to a compass of integrity, of how does this actually impact upon me? How does it impact upon others? I think it's a process of sensitization. And I think this whole movement towards, you know, this willingness to step out of these compulsions is it's many faceted. It doesn't come through a command system, you know, that I need to let go of sensual craving or I need to let go of ill will. This is not going to work. I think there's many facets involved in this shifting from the compulsions of ill will and craving and cruelty into a life of kindness and generosity and freedom. I think there's many facets to it. And all of these facets are drawn from a process of becoming increasingly sensitized inwardly to the impact of the intentions that guide us, the impact of the intentions that lead to our speech and ways of thinking and ways of acting, and how we become aware of what leads towards freedom and what leads towards the end of freedom. The Buddha was only ever concerned with the end of suffering through understanding it. You know, he wasn't concerned with producing clones or, you know, people who had lots of rules that they lived by. You know, he was only ever concerned with suffering, understanding it, and the end of suffering. As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of renunciation arose in me. I understood this. This thought of renunciation has arisen in me. This does not lead to my own affliction or to others' affliction or to the affliction of both. It aids wisdom, doesn't cause difficulties, and leads to nibbana. If I ponder and think upon this thought, intention, even for a night, even for a day, even for a night and a day, I see nothing to fear from it. I see nothing to fear from it. There's nothing to fear from renunciation. There's nothing to fear from kindness or compassion. But then we get into this word renunciation, which I think is a little tricky because, you know, in Western practice, you know, we use this phrase letting go. And I think it's quite unhelpful, actually, per se. I mean, you don't find that translation anywhere in the text. I mean, you do hear the word renunciation. More frequently, you hear the word unbinding. Unbinding. And I think that's a helpful word. We're unbinding from patterns that don't serve us well. You hear the word also abandonment. The reason why I don't find the phrase letting go very helpful is it sounds like an autonomous act. You know, I'm going to let go of something, or you've probably told yourself sometimes, you know, I really should let go of something, or somebody else has told you, you know, you really should let go of that, you know, or you tell somebody else, you know, you really should let go of that. And you notice it doesn't really work, does it? I mean, that's the most thing I think about this autonomous letting go is that it's operationally ineffective. You know, you could shout at yourself all day, I need to let go, I need to let go, I need to let go. And then wonder, why isn't that working? You know? And I think the reason why it's not working is perhaps obvious, you know. I mean, we actually really, if we examine very clearly, you know, we see that there isn't any really fixed, autonomous, independent self. And even though that we see that experientially, somehow we imagine in these times of real clinging and contractedness, you know, that somewhere within me there's this kind of hidden autonomous self that's going to step up to the plate and let go. It actually does not work that way. You know, that's really wishful thinking. In early Buddhist teachings, unbinding or renunciation is actually born of kindness and compassion. It's actually cultivating the conditions that allow for unbinding, which is referring to what I was saying earlier about how there's often a reversal, I think, in early Buddhist teaching, that you don't work on the difficult, you don't let go of things, you don't sort of live in this postponement practice of happiness. You know, they'll be happy after I've worked on this and got rid of this and abandoned this. You actually cultivate the lovely, and this is actually what has the effect of unbinding. And I think for many people, this is a complete reorientation in their practice that I would invite you to consider, you know, not to accept, but even to look in your own experience. You know, I think probably you've all had moments where you've been living or sitting or walking and the mind is very, very agitated or unstable, and a difficult thought or a difficult image arises and it just sticks. It's like the conditions are perfect for contractedness. The conditions are perfect for an ideal storm of clinging. You can be sitting or practicing or living at another time with a mind that feels quite steady and quite calm and quite spacious and quite established, actually, in kindness and care. And exactly the same thought or same image will arise and it just passes right on through. And the content hasn't changed. What has changed is actually the conditions of the mind and body, in which those difficult thoughts are actually appearing in. So from the perspective of the early teachings, you know, you're not going through this process of eradicating in the service of a future happiness or in the service of a future liberation, that the practice is involved in cultivating the conditions in which the mind is inclined towards liberating the moment. Liberating the moment. So that the practice is actually, and it refers back to what I said about cultivating. You know, what is being cultivated, what is being brought into being, what is being nurtured. but with excessive thinking and pondering, even upon the wholesome. I might tire the body, and when the body is tired, the mind becomes disturbed, and when the mind is disturbed, it's far from concentration or collectedness. I steadied my mind internally, quieted it, brought it to single-mindedness, so the mind should not be disturbed. It goes on with this. So he's talking about not clinging even to the wholesome, that this too will lead to as much agitation as clinging to the unwholesome. It's actually cultivating an environment of non-clinging. Cultivating an environment of non-clinging through those intentional cultivations of kindness, of compassion, of renunciation. Does that make sense to you? Please.
Can you read that passage again?
The whole passage?
Just that last piece that you just read.
But I need to tie it in with it a bit before. As I abided thus, diligent, hardened, and resolute, a thought of renunciation arose in me. I understood this. This thought of renunciation, this intention of renunciation has arisen. This does not lead to my own affliction or to others' affliction or to the affliction of both. It leads to wisdom, does not cause difficulty, and leads to nibbana. If I think and ponder upon this thought, even for a night, even for a day and night, I see nothing to fear from it. I see nothing to fear from it. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire the body. And when the body is tired, the mind becomes disturbed. When the mind's disturbed, it's far from collectedness. So I steadied my mind internally, quieted it, brought it to singleness and collectedness. Why is that? So that my mind should not be disturbed. Possibly so. I mean, I think also what's really being pointed out here is that, and I think this is something we can really check out in our own experience, is that whenever we're really tied into the compulsions of ill will or sensual craving or harshness, there is agitation. These are agitated states. You know, they are not places of collectedness and not places of calm. They are actually places where they are in themselves affliction, not just that they lead to affliction, but their nature is agitation. So what the Buddha's pointing out here is that, you know, again, this is not something that's preordained or fixed, that we're developing our capacities for collectedness. You know, we're developing our capacities for quietude, for stillness, and for balance. And it's in those capacities the mind is much less prone to be moving into those agitations, because they actually hold no sweetness, those agitations. They hold no delight, those agitations. I think for us to really know that, you know, and I think this is why often that, you know, sensual craving and ill will and all get so much hold, is unless we know some alternative, that seems like the norm. You know, and what I see in meditative practice as people develop, you know, that what initially feels normal, thought storms of craving or aversion or clinging, what initially needs seems normal, as we develop inwardly and come to a greater sense of stillness, you know, they actually seem abnormal. They're actually seen as an agitation, and the thought of why would I go there, you know, when there's this capacity to actually abide in a greater joy, a greater happiness, a greater contentment inwardly. So again, it's kind of reversing what is normal and what is aberrational. Okay. Whatever a person frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of their mind. If they frequently think and ponder upon thoughts of renunciation, they have abandoned the thought of sensual desire, the intention of sensual desire, to cultivate the thought of renunciation. It's a turning point, isn't it? It's a turning point. It's actually saying, as much as I could practice that, I could practice this. I could actually cultivate this thought of release, of non-contractedness and non-clinging. If they frequently think and ponder upon thoughts of kindness, upon thoughts of compassion, they have abandoned the thoughts of the intentions of ill will and cruelty to cultivate the thought of non-cruelty. And then the mind inclines towards compassion. So this is where you're seeing this reversal. You see this reversal about the choice of actually where we're going to make the home of our attention and intention. Whether it's going to be in the habit patterns that lead to affliction or the capacities that lead to the end of affliction. And what the Buddha is saying here again is there's not coexistence. If you are consciously inclining the mind towards kindness and compassion and renunciation, there isn't the space anymore for the compulsions of craving and aversion and clinging to move in. And this too becomes the shape of the mind, and the shape of our mind becomes the shape of our life. Becomes the shape of our life. So, yes, please. Yes, exactly. Becoming obsessive, becoming clinging, turning it into an ideology is not useful.
But he doesn't say that about kindness and compassion. Is it because that's not possible?
No, he's actually really speaking to the tendency of the mind to almost obsess and contract around anything. You know, I mean, you know, I mean.
But it's interesting because it's particularly about renunciation.
Yeah. He says there's nothing to fear from this intention. There's nothing to fear from this intention. What I think is really important here is to really see that these two things are not coexisting. So if you are cultivating kindness, generosity, and compassion, you are not cultivating. You're not cultivating ill will or cruelty. If you're contemplating the intention of releasing, of non-clinging, you are not cultivating clinging and sensual cravings. It's really just important to recognize. And these are real choices about where we make the home of our attention and intention. Is this interesting to you? I just always sit there and do my own thing, you know. It was really interesting to me.
Days it would be great and we find nothing to fear from it, but if I really tried to think of this like this for 2 days, it would probably tire me, so that's not good.
It actually would energize you.
So what was that piece about?
It's the kind of almost the contracting around it as an ideology, I think, you know. I mean, I see people, you know, have a good, so-called good meditation, you know, and they dwell upon it, think about it, incline upon it, and become incredibly agitated about it. You know, so I think there's actually something quite different about actually, you know, to have it as an intention without obsessing about it.
It's
starting to see where the mind is becoming agitated. It's having that nuancing, starting to see where the mind is becoming agitated because I'm overthinking it. Because I'm overthinking it. Then come to quietude. Come to quietude. Even the craving for renunciation. Even the craving for renunciation.
So there's value in trying to cultivate thoughts of renunciation, and at the same time, we still have to be wary that that can be driven by cravings.
Absolutely. And I think it's keeping your finger on the pulse of agitation. Agitation's always a really important messenger for us, isn't it? And you know, you get familiar with the landscape of agitation, don't you? And, you know, the body's agitated, the mind's agitated. You know, I think agitation is a really important messenger. It's somewhere where we've got a little bit off track, you know? Either through craving or aversion or contractedness or obsession, agitation is a really important messenger that something is just slightly askew. It may only be slightly askew, but the more askew it is, the bigger the agitation. And I think getting familiar with the landscape of agitation is really, really important because it's often our first doorway in. You know, it might be agitation in our speech, it might be agitation in our thinking, it might be agitation in our body. It's often the first messenger that says, you know, okay, we're missing a piece here. We're missing a piece here. Somewhere we're just slightly off track. And if we come to collectedness, come to a sense of collectedness inwardly, will be more sensitized to what's actually slightly askew.
So that's a good direction to go when you notice the agitation is come back to collectedness.
Come back to collectedness. Cultivate the conditions that allow for understanding. Cultivate the conditions that allow for understanding. Craving and aversion and clinging are all control mechanisms. They're all trying to control the world of conditions so that I feel safe. You know, so the releasing is understands a lot, actually, about what refuge is and about what safety is. But they're all control mechanisms. Not necessarily. No, conceptual frameworks are always good. You know, the Buddha's never talking about going beyond conceptual frameworks. You know, he talks about understanding, and conceptual frameworks are part of a journey of understanding. You know, so he's not talking about a state here. That's very important. He's not talking about a state. He's talking about an embodied understanding that is not driven by craving, ill will, or cruelty, or clinging. So he's talking about an embodied understanding which is still going to allow us to move through the world, to articulate that understanding conceptually. You know, so he's actually providing a conceptual framework to understand the kind of places where frameworks have actually not been clear, where they've been distorted. And actually that distortion comes in a little bit later in this discourse. Okay, just the last paragraph I'll finish on, then I think we'll have a sitting before lunch. Just as in the last month of the hot season, when all the crops have been brought inside the villages, a cowherder would guard their cows while staying at the root of a tree or out in the open, since they only need to be mindful that the cows are there So too, there was the need for me only to be mindful that these understandings were present. So the Buddha's actually talking about the amount of effort that is needed to actually cultivate these understandings, the resolution, the diligence, the perseverance. And then he's saying, actually, there's this transition into a place. Actually, you know, the cows are in place. The cows are not going off into the fields, you know. They're kind of not foraging. They're not wild anymore. The cows are actually cooperative. You know, the crops are in. He's actually talking about fruition. You have to remember, this is a very agricultural society that the Buddha lived in. So you almost always use these sort of agrarian kind of metaphors for understanding. Then it goes on. I'll go into this next bit after lunch. He says, tireless energy was aroused in me. An unremitting mindfulness was established. My body was tranquil and untroubled. My mind collected and unified. Quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, I entered upon and abided in the first absorption. I directly knew birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, and there is no more coming to any state of being. It was quite a short trip, wasn't it? From two kinds of thoughts to nirvana, you know. Just through a few paragraphs, that was quite a journey. So you can see there's so much that's actually built into these few paragraphs. It's talking about a whole journey of transformation. And actually in the next paragraph, he describes actually what's at the root of that transformation, which perhaps we'll go into after lunch. But right now I'd like to suggest that we take a moment to stand first and stretch.